Okay, it's July 2nd, approximately 9:15. Matthew White for the Sam Proctor Oral History Program is interviewing Steve Cartado. Mm-hmm. My apologies. At the Panama Canal reunion. And first, if you could, just why don't you give me just a brief overview of your involvement with the Panama Canal, just sort of the umbrella sort of
narrative. My personal.
Yeah, your personal. Experience? Yeah. Well, when did you get there? How long were you there? When did you leave?
That's I was born there in 1951. Mm-hmm. I was a third generation at that time, and I left in 1971. So I was there about 19 mm-hmm. years, and grew up there, went to school, had a great life, mm-hmm. and just didn't work out that I was going to stay there. Mm-hmm. I would like to have, but
okay,
it didn't work out.
Well, let's come back to that. You said third generation. So talk to me a little bit about your ancestors, when they got there, who they were.
Well, my grandfather, he was John Eugene Ridge. He came from Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh area, mm-hmm. With three of his brothers. And I got some notes here from him.
Sure, you bet.
My grandfather came down in November of 1909 when he was 19, and his two older brothers, Joseph Patrick Ridge, was a steam shovel engineer, and he worked with the canal in 1905. Aloysius Peter Ridge in 1908, and then my mom thinks in 1911, Stephen Mark Ridge and Leo Martin Ridge came down to work. So that's
five. And I assume these are your mother's.
Yeah, these are my mother's
relatives.
Yeah, her uncles. And my grandmother had a sister, I think, let's see, was she married to Larry? Yeah. And wrote my mother and said, there's a lot of bachelors down here. Mm-hmm. And so she went down, and the story is she went to a dance before she was married. Larry had invited her to a dance, and for some reason he couldn't go, so he said to my grandfather, hey, would you take her? And they ended up getting married. So the brothers, I think all the other brothers left. Jack was the only one who stayed mm-hmm. down there. And he had 11 kids, of which seven of them stayed down there. My mom and my Uncle John, Uncle Bob, Uncle Pat, Uncle Bubber, and they worked in various areas. Uncle John worked for the water treatment plant. Uncle Bubber and Uncle Bob both worked for the oil bunkering plant, you know, fueling the ships that came through.
Sure.
Uncle Pat was a canal pilot. My mom did various clerical work, and she ended up being the secretary to the governor.
Okay.
And I was born in 51. I have a sister. My dad went down in the Army in 1933. He was okay. A musician. Yeah, he played in the Army band.
Okay.
And another story my mom just told me was that they arrived in Panama on St. Patrick's Day of 1933. Mm-hmm. They arrived in Colon, and they were shipped over to the Pacific side. They were going to be at Fort Clayton, and they had a dance that night at the American Legion Club, I think it was, in mm-hmm. Amador. And so the band had to play for that dance, mm-hmm. and turns out that my grandfather and grandmother attended that dance. So his future in-laws were there, you know, unbeknownst to him. And they didn't get married until, I think, 1947 mm-hmm. or 48. Mm-hmm. But he got out of the Army. Well, while he was down there, he played in various local orchestras as mm-hmm. well, you know, moonlighting.
Sure.
And he'd go on bivouac, he told us. They'd be out, you know, out in the bush camping out and Pecora or somewhere, and one of the guys, I think his name was Avelino Munoz had an orchestra that he played in. He'd come out and pick him up at the bivouac, take him into town, they'd mm-hmm. play their gig, and he'd bring him back. And anyway, when he got out of the Army, he was from Paterson, New Jersey. He went back to Jersey, and the guys in the band came up and said, hey, why don't you come back down to Panama?
Now, did he know your mom at that point?
No, he didn't.
No, okay.
Yeah. So he came back down to Panama, and he played in the local orchestras. He got hired with the Canal Company. Mm-hmm. He was in the claims branch. I'm not sure exactly what they did. They handled reimbursements for various expenditures mm-hmm. and different things like that. And that's where he met my mom. She ended up working under him in the claims branch.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say orchestra, was it a, you know, symphony orchestra?
No, it was orchestra? More jazz orchestra. He played flute, clarinet, saxophone, and he had dance bands in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. They would play proms and balls and mm-hmm. stuff like that. You know, it was a small, maybe like a 8 or 10 piece orchestra. Mm-hmm. They had a violin. You know, I'm looking at some of the old pictures.
Sure.
A violin, a saxophone, maybe a guitar, a drummer, a bass player, a piano player, mm-hmm. something like that.
Sure.
Know?
Was there a thriving jazz scene in
Panama? I don't know if it was a jazz scene per se, and he used to tell me that you know, when bebop came along, he just mm-hmm. kind of hung up his horn because he didn't go outside the box. Pretty much, he was mm-hmm. pretty mainstream, big band stuff. He loved mm-hmm. the swing,
sure.
swing era stuff, Benny Goodman, you know, that kind of stuff. And but the some of the photos we have. It was a thriving scene. There's one from the El Rancho ballroom down there, and you know, it could have been out of Vegas. They're all mm-hmm. in their, you know, white tuxes with the rose or carnation or whatever, mm-hmm. and the dancing girls in their glitter suits, mm-hmm. and it's just really.
Now, is this in Panama or in the zone?
In Panama.
In Panama.
Yeah, this would have been in Panama.
Okay.
I think the zone was much more straight laced. Mm-hmm. You know. Always was in my experience too, you know. They, you know, I mean, there might be a bar at the local officers' club or something, mm-hmm. you know, where people would hang out. But
did you ever go to see him play, or had he hung it up by then?
No, he'd play at home.
Yeah,
and he, you know, he gave us music lessons and stuff like that. But mm-hmm. Yeah, but he came. I don't know if his family was that musical, but. He also played the mandolin, it was an Italian family, mm-hmm. and his parents had come over from Italy, so they worked in a silk mill. They were silk weavers. And,
mm-hmm. In Italy or in Jersey?
In Italy and in Jersey. Yeah, and so he grew up around that, but you know, later years I went through their attic and I found this old, you know, teardrop-shaped mm-hmm. mandolin, you know, and by that time, I was playing electric guitar, so I took the pick guard off of the mandolin and put it on my electric guitar and ruined both instruments. Uh-huh. But yeah, so and he became the chief of the claims branch mm-hmm. over the years. So that's
okay. Yeah, and then but how did he meet your mother then?
Well, she worked under him.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
She worked under him, and she had been dating John DeGrummond, who was second generation. His father had come down. I think his father was a commissary division for many years. And Jack ended up in the treasury division. He later became the treasurer. Mm-hmm. And so when would this have been? In probably the early 40s, maybe. Mm-hmm. Dated my mom, dated and dated and dated, and he went to off on vacation one year, and she said, Jack, you know, if you haven't proposed to me by the time you leave, I may not be waiting for you when you get back. And you go, oh, you'll be waiting. And he went on vacation, and my dad proposed to her, and she accepted. So when Jack came back, it was a done
snooze,
deal.
Lose, yeah.
Yeah, and so they got married, and my dad died in 1968. He had several heart attacks shortly after I was born in the early 50s, in his, I guess, mid-40s. He was, you know, fairly heavy smoker, and he drank quite a bit, and didn't exercise, you know, so mm-hmm. those things catch up to you. And not fatal heart attacks, fortunately, but anyway, he died in 68, and a couple years later, my mom married Jack, so.
It's, yeah. I've noticed that, and that's not the first time I've noticed it either, that people can readily identify who's third, who's second, who's first generation, you know, Zonian. Is that something that you knew about each other? That was there any status associated with that?
No, I don't think so. We just, you know, the community was so, I don't know if the word is insular, but self-contained. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, you know, the families had a history. Mm-hmm. You know, so my grandfather had his whole circle of friends and, mm-hmm. you know, through the church organization or different community organizations. And, you know, that kind of followed through to my mom. She was a very social person, mm-hmm. involved in the church and scouting and, you know, whatever else. There were lots of community organizations for the Catholic community, the Protestant community, mm-hmm. the Jewish community. And, you know, so it was just very interconnected, and people knew who people were. Mm-hmm. And sort of like you might have in a village somewhere, you know, the elders and, you know, the generations like that. Mm. It's just kind of a...
Now, let's go back a little bit. You live... Tell me about your childhood, where you lived, you know, where you went to school, things of that nature.
Well, I was born in Gorgas Hospital in 1951, mm-hmm. and... First lived in Ancon, which I don't remember. We have photographs of. Mm-hmm. It was a four-family wooden structure on concrete piers, mm-hmm. Breezeway, garage underneath, you know. And, the second place, we moved to Los Rios, which was, I think, a fairly new community at the time, or at least that the houses were new that we moved into. And that was a single-family unit. Perched up on a hill, and my mom, she was a pretty avid gardener, and when the houses were built, it was nothing but mud, mm-hmm. around them. There was no landscaping. They didn't put sod in like they might do today.
Right.
They put these clumps of grass in, which would then spread. I guess it was like Bermuda grass.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, by the second rainy season, you had a lush lawn.
Mm-hmm.
And she planted all kinds of native plants, crotons and hibiscus and mm-hmm. everything. She was probably the first house to be totally landscaped in the neighborhood. And I don't remember having that many friends living in that neighborhood, but I was mm-hmm. young at the time, and we'd have birthday parties and stuff like that, and everyone mm-hmm. would get together. But from there, we moved to Gavilan area, which was in Balboa, bordering Amador, which is right on the coast,
mm-hmm.
and Gavilan area, or where most of my early childhood memories are. And I was adding up just some of the families that I remember, and I count at least 50 kids that I knew directly,
uh-huh.
that we would play with in groups or separately. And so if you weren't in school, you got out of school, you got your homework done, and you'd go outside,
mm-hmm.
and someone would be there. Mm-hmm. The houses, let's see, there'd be like, say, two streets, houses on each street, and in between, in the back, was an open yard,
mm-hmm.
all the way down. I mean, there'd be trees, and we had a great mango tree in the back that we could climb up in the mango tree, take a little salt shaker, and pick a green mango and mm-hmm. just peel it off and eat the green mango sitting in the tree. Mm. When we first moved in, there was a kind of a mud path connecting the two streets, which when it rained, it would just be a total mess.
Sure.
And after a few years, they put a sidewalk in and a playground right in back of our house. So we kind of lucked out there, and that was kind of the locus of all the activity mm-hmm. in the neighborhood. And so pretty much any time of day, you'd find somebody out there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we pretty much had the run of the whole neighborhood, which encompassed, I don't know, it was probably about, I guess, maybe a square half mile, which is a pretty good size. Yeah, I don't know how many acres that is and how many houses, but, you know, for there to be 50 kids that I personally knew, there was, you know, probably, you know, 40 families for that many, and, mm-hmm. and maybe, you know, double or triple that much in the neighborhood. And we pretty much had the run of it. It's like, okay, I'm going out to play. Okay, be back at mm-hmm. dusk. And you'd go a couple blocks over and, you know, or I'm going over to Sandy's house, you know, okay, see mm-hmm. you later. You know, you knew you were safe. You know, if they wanted you, they could just holler and be pretty much hear. And that was kind of the rule. You know, you'd wait to hear that yell and then mm-hmm. you'd come home. Later years, one of my buddies, his dad had a cow's horn, you know, cut off that you'd blow.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you'd hear that horn, and you knew that was his signal to head home.
Whatever works.
But, yeah, lots of kids, and for us boys, I think, you know, playing Cowboys and Indians or Army or something was the deal. And, you know, mm-hmm. we'd split up into teams, and there was a kind of a swamp on the edge of the neighborhood, tidal flats is what it really mm-hmm. was, and lots of mangroves and mud, and you know, we kind of like to go down there and imagine we were in the jungle and play like that. You know, there were some older kids in the neighborhood. Mike Herring, it's funny, I talked to him about this later too. Mike Herring and maybe his brother Tim, maybe Luigi Montavani. Anyway, these guys and a couple of us younger kids ended up down on the edge of this tidal flat, and there was this gray, oozy mud down there. And there was some kind of like a storm drain concrete with a, you know, a cast iron cover, and we're standing on right on the edge of this, and they were saying, it's quicksand, jump in. I'm going, no, don't make me jump in. And they, you know, I was scared because they were older.
Yeah,
you know, jump in or we're going to eat you or beat you or whatever it was going to be. So finally, I jumped in, and it wasn't quicksand, and I got totally muddy, and they ran off laughing, and I pulled myself out crying, you know, whimpering. I was probably, I don't know, maybe I was like 5 or 6, and went home in tears to my mom, and my mom tore into those boys. She called up their mom, you know, and mm-hmm. got me cleaned up and everything. So I saw Mike at one of these reunions a while back. I said, Mike, you know, I remember you did this thing to me. He goes, oh, yeah, I was a real asshole back then. You know? But,
so which elementary school did you go to?
Well, I went to St. Mary's Mission Parochial School, the Catholic school.
Oh, okay. Was that in the zone or out in?
Yeah, it was
okay.
A 2-minute walk from my house. Literally right around the corner.
Uh-huh.
And the nuns there, I guess when I was there, they were Franciscan nuns from somewhere stateside. And particularly, say mean nun I had for first grade, Sister Mary Adela. And my family, pretty much, I think they adored those nuns. And my grandfather had a long history of working with the Catholic Church down there. In fact, someone told my mom a story that he lived in the town of Old Gorgona. This woman saw him in there sweeping the church before Mass on Sunday, and he wasn't paid to do it. Mm-hmm. It was just something he thought needed to be done, so he did it. And he ended up working with a community house, which I think at some point, there was a large building right on Balboa Road, sort of used to be the main building of that school. I think it had columns, you know, kind of almost a mm-hmm. classical looking building. And later they expanded the school. But I started there in kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of remember part of this story, since it was so close, recess bell rang.
Mm-hmm.
All the kids went out of school, and I thought it was over, so I went home, which I just disappeared, and they couldn't find me afterwards, and ended up calling the house.
Right.
It was a big to-do. They found me. But I went there through the eighth grade, and then...
So how was your... by the way, I'll interrupt every once in a while. I'll try to keep
that's
that...
That's great, yeah.
So you're the first person I've met here that did go to a private school, a parochial school in the zone. Now, what was that like relative to your, you know, friends who might have gone to the, you know, I guess public school?
Yeah.
What were the differences? What were the similarities?
Well, the difference was mainly that it was a religious school, mm-hmm, so we had catechism classes.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And we were known as the St. Mary's Fairies.
Uh-huh.
In a pejorative way.
Sure, sure.
And we didn't take too much offense at it, and I think it was all in good fun. But surprisingly, I mean, it was a large Catholic community, so mm-hmm. the school was pretty much full. And
did other denominations have their schools?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't believe there was a Jewish school. And as far as the non-Catholics, mm-hmm. just went to the public schools. Mm-hmm. And some Catholic, I was talking to a friend last night. She went there for 1 year. Mm-hmm. You know, her parents said, "Hey, it's your choice," and she went for 1 year.
Now, did
it was for us? It was just a given. You're going to the Catholic
school. Sure, sure. But now, my understanding, there's two things, of course, I want to ask about, because my understanding, of course, of the public schools is the people who I've interviewed who went there. They talk about how planned your life was there, in the sense that not only was there a school, but there was just constant array of activities for you. Just from dance to archery to that the Canal Zone had supplied for the kids. Did you see the same thing in the parochial school?
Well, actually, those were available to all of us.
Okay, so it wasn't
you know,
done
the,
to the
summer program, you just had to sign up. It was like what you might find in a Parks and Rec department today. I took archery one summer, and the YMCA had classes. I took an art class. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was probably about 10, and swimming. Mm-hmm. We all swam. The pool was the other hot spot. We went through the whole, I don't know what it's called, the you know, the beginner BSA, beginner swimming, swimmer advance. Mm-hmm. You know, we had our little stickers on our bathing suits, and you know, the pool was the hot spot, and mm-hmm. Amador Beach. We all had access to the military recreation facilities. Mm-hmm. You know, we had our sticker on our car windshield, you know, Canal employee sticker. So, you know, Saturday, Sunday, we'd go out mm-hmm. to Amador Beach and hang out there. And mm-hmm. kind of privileged, really. It was, especially when you consider the, you know, the country around it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the abject poverty right across the street, you know.
Now, did you have much contact with Panama and the Panamanians?
Yeah.
Were you aware of the poverty?
Yeah.
At that age?
Definitely, definitely. The groups of Panamanian kids would come into the neighborhoods to pick mangoes. Uh-huh. And we would holler at them, you know, we'd yell, "Policia, policia," like, "We're going to call the cops," you know. Mm-hmm. And they might scamper off, or in later years, they kind of, I guess, would just kind of look at us, you know. And, you know, I can remember feeling bad about that at one point, you know, uh-huh. kind of recognizing, oh, you know, that's not right for me to be hollering at them, you know. And, but, you know, we lived in it was pretty much, I don't know if it's, you know, cradle to grave situation. It wasn't luxury necessarily. I mm-hmm. mean, you know, you had a variety of income levels. Uh-huh. So you had the blue collar jobs, the maintenance jobs, the guys mm-hmm. that, for the white community, pretty much, because it was pretty much an apartheid kind of a situation there. The Americans, I should say, were groomed for management jobs mm-hmm. or supervisorial jobs in any of the departments or divisions. Mm-hmm. So if you chose, as I did later, to join the apprenticeship program, you would go in, I guess, with the idea that at some point you would be the head of a crew. Mm-hmm. And your crew would consist mostly of Panamanian local guys mm-hmm. would be the laborers, either the West Indians or Panamanians. And mm-hmm. so, you know, you needed a light bulb change, you call the electrical division, or right, the switch is not working, I will send someone out. Mm-hmm. And then Mr. So-and-so would come with his helper and fix it, the mm-hmm. plumber, you know, Mr. So-and-so would come, you know, mm-hmm. my dad's friend, Mr. Peterson, he was an electrician. There were guys that worked in the electronic shop. Later years, you know, I played in a rock and roll band. If my amp needed fixing, we mm-hmm. took it over to Mr. Foster, and he'd put it right. And, mm-hmm. You know, all those services were provided mm-hmm. for a nominal fee. You know, mm-hmm. I think rent was pretty cheap compared to stateside. Mm-hmm. Income levels weren't that great. You know, my mom tells me, yeah, we didn't have a lot of money. But I don't recall ever wanting for anything. Mm-hmm. We didn't always get the newest, latest car like some of our neighbors might, you know. Mm-hmm. One neighbor, yeah, he got like a new Chevy. Wasn't every year, maybe every other year. Mm-hmm. You know, we kept the car for 5-10 years, mm-hmm. you know. And,
now, where did you buy cars in the canal? So?
Down in Panama. Yeah, they had local car dealers.
Okay.
You know. Smoot y Paredes. Smoot and Paredes. And,
so you were at the Procro School, St. Mary's, till your eighth grade.
Yeah.
Now, did they have a high school?
No, they didn't have a high school.
Okay.
And there was a Catholic high school in Panama, but which, in retrospect, it would have been great to go there and really mm-hmm. get immersed in Spanish, because I never actually learned Spanish mm-hmm. living in Panama. I knew, you know, I could speak words. I could say agua, you know.
Right.
I'm thirsty, tengo sed.
So they didn't teach it at the St. Mary's? Or?
They didn't really teach it at St. Mary's, that I recall. I could be wrong. And later in high school, they did teach it. Mm-hmm. I took Spanish in high school. And you know, I learned enough just to get by. It wasn't until later in college, and you know, I took some classes and mm-hmm. and learned a lot more and went back to Panama and had a great time, you know, speaking. Because, you know, I was more in tune to it then, more mm-hmm. in tune to the culture going back. Mm-hmm. I could appreciate it more than growing up there, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of growing up there. You didn't really have any need to learn Spanish. We had pretty much English-speaking maids. Mm-hmm. That was another thing. We had maids growing up, you know, housekeepers. Usually just for the day, but later we had some part-time live-in, mm-hmm. you know, maids who would clean and cook and, you know, generally take care of us while our parents worked. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the Catholic school, it was different. It was much more disciplined, I think, than the public mm-hmm. schools. They were much more... Yeah, academically, I think they were probably on a par.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my next question. Other people have spoken very highly of the teachers at the public schools.
Yeah.
I was wondering if it was the...
Yeah. Yeah, the academic standards were pretty high, and I didn't have any trouble transitioning to mm-hmm. the public school. But, yeah, we would march through town to assemblies. The church was, you know, maybe a quarter of a mile away. Mm-hmm. So we'd line up and march through town mm-hmm. at the steps of the church.
School uniforms?
Yeah, school uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I guess there was a little hint of always that wondering, gee, what's it like to be out free in the public school world, you know, because we're so constrained, you know, with the nuns. But, I had some really good teachers that I liked a lot, and then I had some that were just, they seemed to have a chip on their shoulder, you know?
Sure. Well, that's true.
The Franciscans, I think, you know, it's because they had to wear those wool, heavy mm-hmm. black wool dresses, you know? Mm-hmm. And then the Sisters of Mercy came down from New York, and someone was saying they complained that all their kids were picking up New York accents. But, They wore white, lightweight cotton dresses, so, and they were a little nicer. So.
Yeah. So the high school, you went to?
Balboa. I went to Corundu Junior High School.
Okay, Corundu Junior,
which was a new school.
Okay.
I guess at that time was maybe only a year or two old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had built a big geodesic dome for the cafeteria, mm-hmm. auditorium, brand new school, and that was kind of like getting out into the real world.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Did you have trouble breaking into sort of this already? I mean, you already knew the people, kids there.
Yeah, sure. You know, yeah. When school was out, your uniform was off.
Sure.
And then, you know, everyone was part of the gang. The you know, as kids, you don't inquire much about, you know, faith. So if you had a Jewish friend, we never talked about, you know, Judaism or Protestantism, mm-hmm. you know, the differences or whatever. It was just, you know, something you had to do on Sunday, pretty much.
Uh-huh.
For us, it was every day because it was church,
sure,
you know.
Sure.
But the community became much larger, mm-hmm. at that point, because you were part of that larger group.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you were part of you had more friends from more town sites. Because mm-hmm. there was Balboa, there was Diablo, Los Rios, Corundu, the military, and some Panamanians,
mm-hmm.
at that point. And so you just made more friends, you had more connections.
Mm-hmm.
And you just, you know, got more of a sense of how your community worked, who the gangs were, you know, who the you know, the tough kids were, and mm-hmm. who the bookish kids were, and, you know, where do I fit into this world?
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, that's what's happening to you anyway.
Sure, sure, absolutely. So, yeah, it's not that much difference,
yeah,
in some
you
ways.
You know, and you're just kind of finding your way. And
mm-hmm.
At that time, I started playing guitar. Well, I started when I was 13.
So, yeah, what age are we talking about here? 13,
so, 13,
so it's about
14,
1964,
in eighth grade.
65?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I remember writing letters in I guess, seventh and eighth grade. To the GIs in Vietnam,
uh-huh.
you know, just support letters. Yeah, we're proud of you for,
mm-hmm.
you know, saving us from communism and that kind of stuff. And,
mm-hmm. Now, how much living in the Canal Zone, and you, of course, you mentioned Vietnam, but how much were you aware of what was going on? So we're talking about 1963, 64. We're talking a lot of change, you know, a lot of events in the States, larger civil rights, Vietnam. How much?
Yeah. We were pretty aware of all of that, especially at that time, being in high school,
mm-hmm.
you know, in 68. Well, my dad died in 68, so that had a big impact on me. Mm-hmm. I was 16, and I think I was just kind of a loss for a personal hero or mm-hmm. role model at that point. And you know, we had gotten Life or Saturday Evening Post, Life Magazine, National Geographic,
mm-hmm.
and I just remember just reading all those articles and seeing the pictures of the guys who died that week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there'd be a 2-page spread or three, you know,
mm-hmm.
120 pictures, and just looking at that.
Of dying in Vietnam?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and our news outlet was mainly the Armed Forces
mm-hmm.
Radio and Television Service, later Caribbean Forces Network and Southern Command Network after that. And, you know, it was limited, but even then, which is surprising, the nightly news had the footage of Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
the coverage from Vietnam. I think as a rule, the community was pretty patriotic.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the Boy Scouts. Our church sponsored a troop, and, you know, it was all the kids I'd grown up with, you know, maybe a dozen of
mm-hmm.
us were in the Boy Scouts, and we had a couple of our scoutmasters were in the military.
Mm-hmm.
One was a PFC, Steve Lieber. Another guy, Pete Hanlon, he was in the Navy. And Pete had access to a landing craft. I guess his job was to pilot this landing craft mm-hmm. to do support missions to the, there was some kind of a radar station on Taboga Island just
mm-hmm.
off the coast. And So he'd shuttle back and forth, and so he'd take us out on camping trip. We camped out on Toboga, we camped in the Perilous Islands, like that. Anyway, so we had some involvement with the military. My sister was a couple years older. She dated a couple guys in the Army. I don't know how they met, even, unless, I don't know how they got together. Well, I know my sister.
Soldiers will find a way.
Say again?
Soldiers will find a way.
Yeah. Well, at that point, there was much more interaction. We're talking 68, 69. Mm-hmm. Just from the local hangouts, you know. Parades, local parades, the Army was always in the parade, the 4th of July parade, the Veterans Day parade, and as kids, you know, we were like, oh, wow, you know, check this out, isn't this cool, you know. And they did a lot of training down there, the military, for Vietnam, and our house was right on the approach to Albrook Air Force Base. Used to fly U-2 flights out of there, I think, to Cuba. I'm not sure exactly where, but they'd take off in the morning and they'd come back at dusk. And there was a, I guess they'd do a helicopter training, because there'd be these, you know, eight Hueys would take off, fly off, they'd fly off to the West Bank. We were out there one night, and they had some kind of exercise going on, and the Hueys were flying over, and then they'd come back, you know. So, you know, we were aware that all that was going on in addition to the news, and I guess around about that time we started having more friends who were in the military, in interacting with them more on a social basis, and either guys that were en route to Vietnam or were in the canal zone and glad to be there instead of Vietnam, you know.
So actually the U-2 story reminds me of a question, and I ask, just to preface this a little bit, you know, the couple of people I've talked to are actually quite a bit older than you, and so they'll have a lot of stories about how World War II affected the canal zone. So now I'm thinking, where you should be old enough by this point to be aware of, for example, the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is quite close to you in a way.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
Do you remember that? Effect did it have on life in the canal?
Well, we were all totally paranoid. You know, sort of like the Russians are coming, which I guess that's what it was all about.
Exactly.
You know, and we weren't we weren't that far away. I mean, Miami was a lot closer, but still, I can recall. So maybe it was, I know there was a coup, there was several coups. I think one was in 59, was it in 59?
Yeah. In Panama.
In Panama. And it might have been the later one, which I think was 64, where the rumor was there were Cuban guerrillas up in Chiriqui province next to Costa Rica. They had infiltrated and, you know, it was a very real threat, and, you know, it was to be feared and opposed. And, you know, as kids, we're like, oh, well, whatever. That's sort of like, okay, you know, I understand, because, you know, the Cold War was all the duck and cover stuff, too.
Sure,
you know, we'd have air raid drills and we'd run down to the garage and, you know, watching the Sputnik, you know. We had a black and white TV and, you know, I had a little model of the whatever that first rocket was that launched John Glenn around, you know, in his first orbit. You know, that was all big stuff for us. And then, you know, we were like super, super proud to be Americans, you know, and, you know, second in space or whatever it was. And, but by the time the Vietnam War came along, one of my best friends was in the ROTC, and I have to laugh because I can't talk about all the stories.
Well, you know, share what you want.
But he was like, we called him the general because he was like the chief, whatever his rank was. You know, he was up there in the ROTC. He had the saber and would, you know, command the ROTC brigade.
Now, is this at the high school? ROTC?
At the high school, okay. Yeah, Balboa High School, yeah. At that time. And he later had a career. Mm-hmm. I think he retired as a major or maybe a colonel, and was stationed for many years in Germany. Mm-hmm. So he was on the front line. Had anything happened, he would have been. But he took a... They did some kind of training at the Special Forces training camp on the Atlantic side. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where that was, in Gatun or somewhere over there. Fort Gulick Special Warfare Training Center or whatever it was. He talked about, they had this mock-up Vietnamese village, you know, thatched huts and stuff like that. And, yeah, we had to go over there and, you know, do this, mm-hmm. this training. And, we were aware of the School of the Americas, mm-hmm. you know, training the counterinsurgency forces for all of Latin America. Mm-hmm. We had no idea what was going on there. And, you know, later we find out now, sort of, that some of it was pretty nefarious, you know. And
how does that affect your memories of that time period, now that you found out that,
you know? It doesn't really change my experience at all. Mm-hmm. We were pretty much happy-go-lucky. Mm-hmm. And several friends of mine, my first band, I had a band in junior high school. So we'd play the local school dances, and a couple of the guys were, let's say, maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 years older. Mm-hmm. And they pretty much all went into the military. Mm-hmm. I remember Curtis Searcy was in the Air Force. In fact, he might have even been in the Air Force at that time. But he was from Corundu. Mike Vishoni and Nelson Barrero, they were like our three singers. Mm-hmm. So we had this band, guitar, two guitars, maybe bass, drums, and maybe a keyboard at one time or another, and these three up front singers, you know, with the white t-shirts, rolled up sleeves, tight black jeans,
okay,
singing The Monkees and, you know, Paul Revere and the Raiders and mm-hmm. what, you know, and we would play at the local NCO clubs. Mm-hmm. VFW, the American Legion. Mm-hmm. So we would be playing for these lifers, these master sergeants, mm-hmm. who were tough old crackers, you know, and I think, well, I know there was some resentment. I can tell you that in 1960, could have been 67 even, I got it in my head to take a army shirt and cut off the sleeves and write POW on the back in a black marker. Mm-hmm. And from one of the car magazines, like a model car magazine, in the back they always had ads for, you know, plastic German helmets and stuff mm-hmm. like that, you know, the sure. Iron Cross and all uh-huh. that stuff was big. So I got this plastic German helmet. And we walked into a local clubhouse. This was actually in the zone in Diablo Clubhouse one night after we played at a teen club or NCO club or something. Walked in the back to get some fries, and there are these two or three master sergeants sitting at a table, mm-hmm. and they wanted to kick my ass.
And how old were you?
I was like 15, mm-hmm. and they were steamed, mm-hmm. and rightly so. I mean, yeah. here's this, you know, young kid who's, you know, knows nothing about mm-hmm. the war that they're coming back from or going to mm-hmm. or have seen, you know, and mm-hmm. has no respect for them, which we didn't really, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, because we didn't know better. Mm-hmm. I mean, at that age, another couple of years, I would have known better and maybe mm-hmm. would have been deferential or maybe not. But at that point, it was mm-hmm. totally innocent. And fortunately, we had these older guys there that were able to stand between us and say, hey, you know, you better take that shirt off, Steve. You know, you're really pissing mm-hmm. these guys off. And mm-hmm. and so those guys going into the service, I didn't know too many personally that went to Vietnam. And one, I didn't know you went to Vietnam until years later, and we talked mm-hmm. about it. He told me about his experiences going, you know, illegally into Cambodia and mm-hmm. conducting covert operations and stuff like that. And he was still very proud of that and patriotic about it, you know. And I, on the other hand, was glad that I didn't get called up. I had a high draft number. I mm-hmm. think it was 285 or something like that, mm-hmm. whereas a couple of my friends got drafted and actually got stationed in the zone. And one of them got the job as the LCM driver doing that support run.
Oh.
And he lived at home. Mm-hmm. The other one, I think, lived at home for a while, too. And he was stationed at Fort Amador. And, you know, my mom saw him out there cleaning up mangoes under the mango tree on the golf course, you know, mm-hmm. one day. And I had a picture of out of Life magazine of some drill sergeant. They had mm-hmm. an article on the Marines, which I read mm-hmm. on boot camp, and this was maybe late 68 or something, and freaked me out, totally mm-hmm. terrified me. I thought, this is not for me.
Right.
And yeah. I tacked that picture up on my bookcase, and I had acquired a bayonet, a small bayonet, mm-hmm. in the course of my Boy Scouts, you know.
Sure.
And I took the bayonet and stuck it in the guy's forehead. And mm-hmm. so that was, you know, you walk into my bedroom, you know, in addition to all the other crap that you have hanging around, mm-hmm. you know, Jimi Hendrix posters, and there was this picture of the drill sergeant with the bayonet, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, had I been called up, I don't know if I would have gone or not, you mm-hmm. know, I just don't know. But, you know, we had guys that, let's say they would run afoul of the law in one way or another, Army guys, friends mm-hmm. of ours. They would get their heads shaved. If they were arrested in Panama, they would take them in, shave their heads. They would call
the Panamanians would shave their heads.
Yeah, Panamanians would instantly shave their heads, and we call them cocobolo. Mm-hmm. And they would get sent to special forces training. You know, that's their punishment.
Uh-huh.
You know, which, you know. So. You know, that the counterculture was really taking off late mm-hmm. 68, 69, 70, 71.
Uh-huh.
You know, just like it was in the States. You know, sure. We had a big peace march, I think, I don't remember exactly when, maybe it was 1970. Mm-hmm. And we all wore these black armbands, and we mm-hmm. did a candlelight procession, I think, from La Boca to the center of town, Balboa. And,
now, how did that go over? Because as you said before, and what I've gathered from other people, this is a very patriotic community.
Yeah, well, it was tough. It was tough for a lot of people. You know, at that time, this was like the hippie days and the mm-hmm. drug culture and all of that. And there were a lot of problems. There was a lot of involvement with that I won't go into.
Uh-huh.
But it caused a lot of families a lot of problems, mm-hmm. and you know, some kids went over the edge, mm-hmm. and never recovered. Others died. You know, so it's almost like it took that to expose a sort of a facade,
mm-hmm.
you know, of life being perfect,
mm-hmm.
which we all sort of knew it wasn't. And, you know, I mean, we know life is not perfect. You know,
right.
People
right.
have problems because
sure.
we're people and we live together.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's in my family especially, it was sort of like, well, we don't talk about those things. We don't talk about those problems.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that never helped them get any better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if someone had a mental illness or a deformity, I had an aunt, I there was 11 kids in my family.
You had 10 brothers and sisters?
No, in my mom's family.
Oh, in your mom's family. Say, I'm
yeah,
sorry. I'm
in
sorry.
My mom's family. Aunt Rita, I think, was the baby. And she was mentally mm-hmm. handicapped and physically handicapped. And I never knew I had an Aunt Rita
mm-hmm.
until I was 16. And she died, I think, 2 days before my dad died.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of when I found out I had an Aunt Rita. I never met her.
And where was she?
She was in Corozal, which was the mental hospital.
In the zone.
In the zone, yeah. Corozal Mental Hospital, I guess. I'm not sure exactly what they called it. But she was there. And, you know, my grandfather used to go visit her all the time. my mother would go visit her, never took me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if she didn't want me to know or what, but you know, how could I live to be 16 and not know I had an arita? That was, maybe I knew, but it was never
right
forefront in my consciousness, you mm-hmm. know? And, you know, because there were other families that had kids with Down syndrome who were out in the neighborhood playing, you know, come mm-hmm. over to my house, you know. It was, hey, Tony, what's going on, you know? Mm-hmm. We know something not right with you, but you're right. One of us, you know?
Right.
So, but it just sort of seemed in my family, things were sort of covered up a little bit. And, mm-hmm. You know, later, there were other problems, mm-hmm. you know? And my dad, he drank a lot, and I think that's because he was afraid, because he had had heart attacks, mm-hmm. you know, and he just, I don't know, maybe he had a lot of anxiety about that, you know, as a way of coping. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the community, there was an active police force. And of course, growing up, they all knew us and we all mm-hmm. knew them. You know, I didn't get in trouble, but a bunch of us at Fort Amador, they had coastal defenses built for World War I. They had these series of tunnels and gun emplacements on one of the islands out there. And one afternoon, we said, hey, yeah, let's go out to the bunkers and check it out. So we went out, and they had these steel gates at sort of road level, and here was a hill. And inside the hill, there was a long stairway, maybe a couple hundred feet long, going mm-hmm. up into the defenses in the middle of this hill, mm-hmm. concrete and everything, and the gates were never locked. So mm-hmm. in we went, you know, yeah. we're 14 years old, let's go check it out. You know, by that time we were probably smoking cigarettes, and I don't even remember if we had a flashlight. It was pitch black in there, and you could go from one end of the island, you could say, go around the top and go into one of these bunkers, down into the tunnels, and come out at the far end of the island, mm-hmm. you know, without ever going out on the surface. Mm-hmm. Or you could go out in any number one of entrances, you know. And so there was this room of electrical switches, which probably powered, you know, some hoist for ammunition or something. And they had these wooden handles on them. And I thought, I'll take a souvenir. So I unscrewed this wooden handle, put it in my pocket. And I ended up keeping it, but the next thing we know, we see these flashlights coming up the stairs or something, or either we were on our way out and the MPs had stopped there, mm-hmm. military police. And, wait, what are you guys doing? You know, oh, well, nothing. We're just, you know, hanging out. He said, well, you better come with us. So they took us down to Balboa Police Station. You know, no evidence of any misdeeds or anything, but they knew we were 14 and up to no good.
Sure, so exactly.
They took us to the police station and took us in, and Mr. Philo, dad of a good friend of mine and longtime friend of the family, was the desk sergeant that day. Oh, Steve Cartado, eh? Oh, what's going on? You know, well, we were out in the bunkers and, you know, nosing around and whatever. You know, well, I better call your mom. So he called my mom, and, you know, it wasn't a big deal, but the point was that we knew all the policemen, mm-hmm. they knew us, they knew our parents. And in later years, I talked to one of the detectives, Joe Grills. Mm-hmm. At the time, you know, they would follow us around.
Uh-huh.
You know, because let's just say we were up to no good. In a sense, mm-hmm. we were fully engaged in experiencing the counterculture.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and you're 16, 17, 18.
Max, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, in Panama, it's sort of, let's say when I was 15 or so, my mom and sister decided to go on a diet.
Mm-hmm.
So the doc put them on benzedrine and amphetamines.
Mm-hmm.
And they were bouncing off the walls, mm-hmm. and then they'd crash. And moody and bitchy.
Sure.
Fighting. And I had no clue, you know, right. What's going on? Oh, yeah, well, I don't know, but we're on a diet, you know? and so my sister is like, let's say 16, 17 then. She gets to 18, it's counterculture. We know that we can just go down to the pharmacy and pick up whatever we want. No prescription needed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's across the board. Mm-hmm. At 14, you could go down to the local bodega, the local liquor store, and pick up a bottle of rum, a bottle of whiskey, mm-hmm. you know, which a lot of us did. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're talking about underage drinking, you're talking about underage smoking, you're mm-hmm. talking about underage unregulated pharmaceutical use, mm-hmm. and then other substances came online, and it all flowed freely. Mm-hmm. And so I was going to say that later years, well, these guys would follow us around in all our escapades, and we recognized them. Mm-hmm. When we saw them, you know, you could recognize a police car a mile away.
Sure.
And marked or unmarked. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, we were just looking out for you. Mm-hmm. You know, we weren't out to get you. We were just looking out for you. And I get a little emotional thinking about it because, you know, we hated them so much mm-hmm. for interfering in our affairs. But, you know, some of us didn't get through it. So, you know, and I have to say, you know, my mom being the governor's secretary at the time, you know, we put her at great risk by, mm-hmm. you know, our antics. And so, and it wasn't that she was clueless, but with my dad having passed, she was incapable of dealing with two kids that were that rebellious, you know, at mm-hmm. the time. And so, you know, we were always respectful to authority, you know, to the adults, to the mm-hmm. teachers and everything. And we didn't get in trouble at school. And, well, not much anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, no more than normal.
Sure.
And, but, you know, we got through it. Mm-hmm. And but the military at that time, you know, all the things that were happening in the military in Vietnam, you know, guys coming back addicted and whatever, that all kind of funneled in a big current. Mm-hmm. You know, all the guys that would come down through the canal zone brought all the influences and mm-hmm. substances from the States, you know, and mm-hmm. so it was a kind of a strange time in a way, because mm-hmm. you know, you were aware of all of that. You know, movies like Apocalypse Now hadn't come out yet and wouldn't right. for another 10 or 15 years, but you know, you could sort of see it happening. You mm-hmm. could see that these, you know, young 20 year olds, you know, were in a strange world, you know, of having mm-hmm. to fight a war that was unpopular, and mm-hmm. you know, they'd come through the canal zone and experience this community of complete freedom. You know, mm-hmm. as kids, we had the run of the place. Mm-hmm. We could go anywhere we wanted in the country of Panama. Anywhere. Mm-hmm. And as long as we could get back to the zone, it was like a game of tag. Uh-huh. If you reach base, you're safe. Pretty much.
Right.
You know, things started to unravel a little bit around 70, 71. They sort of had I don't know that they ever came to any like actual laws that if you were caught in Panama, you were prosecuted in Panama, because mm-hmm. it seemed there was always someone that would come and bail us out. Mm-hmm. You know, if we got caught doing something yeah. illegal in Panama.
How often did you get caught doing something?
I never did.
Oh, okay.
My sister did. Mm-hmm. And someone pulled a string. You know, a friend of mine did. Someone pulled a string. Mm-hmm. And either nothing would be said or something serious would happen, mm-hmm. sort of like that. If I mean, you might be deported. Mm-hmm. Your family might be asked to leave, mm-hmm. you know.
Now, again, without... you know, saying getting anyone else in that, trouble,
but this will be the 25-year
okay, you can negotiate that, right? So, but how big was this community of the counterculture? How if you had to characterize it?
I'd say maybe of the kids I knew, probably not that big, but I think 2,000 in a 3-year high school, mm-hmm. 2,000, I'd say maybe there was a couple hundred. Mm-hmm.
So maybe, and then how many of those families might have been deported for the, you know, the shenanigans of their kids?
I'd say maybe, I don't even know if a family was actually sent out. I know some kids were.
Okay.
A small percentage, a very small percentage yeah. of that. But it was a, I'm not even sure, I guess I'm sure there was a stigma of it, you know, among, well, it was just hard because if it's, let's say you're a high level government position there and your kid is, you know, bucking the system and your job's on the line,
right?
You know, so it's, you know, it wasn't good for our parents.
No.
You know, and, it wasn't that good for us in retrospect, although we did have a good time. And, you know, it just without any regulation, without any restraints, you know, some kids couldn't handle it.
I just noticed it's about 10:15, and I wanted to, so where we are, there will be somebody in here about 10:30. And on a more so political level, so you were in high school at a very interesting time for the canal relative to the local pandemoniums. I believe it was 1964. Was the protests about the flag and everything like that. And I'm wondering, given your age during that time period and where you were, what how you experienced all that?
Well, I have two pretty strong memories of that. One is that I wasn't present at the big confrontation at the local high school.
If I'm doing the math right, you were still in junior high at the confrontation at the high school.
Yeah.
I'm just doing my head, but please correct me if I'm wrong.
Went to high school. But our neighbor, one of our next door neighbor, we lived in a duplex, and our duplex neighbor, I recall him sitting out in, he had a Jeep, and I believe he had a shotgun in his Jeep. And I could be wrong, and I think he's still around, Chris Skye, saying, hey, they're not coming down this street, you know? Because, you know, I mean, you know, it's sort of like, okay, the border's a mile away, and they're coming en masse. There's a huge crowd coming. You know, we got to defend ourselves, you know, get your musket, and, you know, batten down the hatches. And so it was tense that way, and our neighbor next door was a policeman, Ed Hewson. He came down and gave us a .45 and a box of bullets. He said, you know, you lock your door and you take this gun, and anyone comes through that door, you pull the trigger. You don't have to worry about aiming it, you know. And so that's how tense it was. It was sort of like, you'll be fighting for your life. That was the vibe. The reality, I don't think, was anywhere near that. But, you know, it for me, in retrospect, that was a long time coming. There should have been a Panamanian flag there all along, you know, and it's sort of, I consider myself, you know, patriotic in the way that, you know, when my son goes, we go to a baseball game, I take my hat off and put my hand over my heart when we sing the national anthem. But I'm aware of, you know, the gray areas in our history too, you know, and the dark side, which, you know, we never learned about growing up. And now my kid in history class, he learns about the Trail of Tears.
Right.
You know, I was never told about a Trail of Tears. I was never told about genocide of the Native peoples, you know, and so that kind of stuff. And now I see it all in a different light. And, you know, the world's a different place to me now. So I'm not a, you know, a wild flag waver, you know, and it's just a different perspective. The canal zone was unique in that way. It was a Teddy Roosevelt stamp on it. You know, it's like, this is manifest destiny. This is what we're all
about.
Did
you recognize that when you were there, or did that only come later, maybe you moved out?
Well, it came later when I moved out. You know, growing up, it was just an idyllic situation. We didn't have crime. You know, we didn't have poverty. We didn't, you know, on the surface, it was just a Swiss clock, you know? And, you know, later you realize, well, okay, but there's people involved in this. And so that's the rub, you know? People have issues, you know, and nobody's perfect. And transitions have to happen. And in 1979, I went back for the ceremony sort of. The party really is was going to be a party, because the ceremony, I think, happened. And there was one big party out at Diablo Yacht Club, where some friends of mine were playing, and I got up and jammed with them, and it was just a big party, a bunch of us. And my uncle Pat was taking a ship through the canal. As it came by, he gave a long honk on the horn as he passed the party. And you know, for me, that was all supposed to happen. That was the right thing to do. And I'm a big fan of Jimmy Carter, you know, anyway, which, you know, puts me at odds with most of my relatives. And you know, my mom had one of those calendars with a green gremlin giving the finger, you know, whatever it was, thanks Jimmy for nothing, or, you know, something to that effect. But, you know, and I walked by the supply division, and there was like a mock gravestone in the display window saying, here lies the body of, you know, building 614 or whatever it was, rest in peace, you know, because, you know, a lot of people lost their jobs, and, you know, there was a lot of anxiety, and I was long gone by then, and so my perspective had already changed. But, you know, it was a good thing. Some friends stayed on, and you know, I have to admire that. I went back in 95 with my wife. A friend of mine, Jim Ganser, worked on Miraflores Locks, and took us on a tour, let my wife lock a ship through, you know, in the control tower. And it was great to see him interacting with his crew, who were, you know, West Indian heritage. You know, we could all talk Bajan, and anyway, he told me that they had a big carnival that year, and there was a bridge that connects the two sides of the locks. It used to be an alternative to the ferry before the Thatcher Ferry Bridge was built in 62. We used to take the ferry across from the East Bank to the West Bank to go up to the interior of Panama. So this bridge was an alternative at Fort Clayton. The bridge hadn't been used in years, rusted shut. So he had to go dig out the plans, and he and his crew went through and took it all apart, put it all back together, got it working, because there was going to be so much traffic for this carnival, they needed the overflow. And he was really proud of that, and I was too, you know. It's like, wow, you know, that's the spirit that made the canal a great place to work, you know, to achieve something like that, that would last that long and still function, you know, precisely and accurately when it needed to. And, you know, all through the years, the innovations in navigation or whatever, you know, even growing up, you know, we used to marvel at it. You know, I'd see that big ship coming through and I'd go, dang, you know, that's pretty cool. Pretty cool. You know, I tell my friends, yeah, I grew up in Panama, the Panama Canal. Oh, yeah, that's, you know, that's pretty awesome. You know, what was it like? Well, it was great. It was great living there. You know, great place to grow up. And
So tell me a little bit about why you left.
Well, I was an apprentice, heavy equipment operator, out of high school. You know, me and a bunch of friends, we joined the apprentice program. And had a job with the maintenance division, operating cranes and assorted other heavy equipment. And there's a year probationary period. And so this is 1971. And that whole counterculture thing was still peaking. And I was hanging out with the wrong crowd. I'll say it that way. And so that was essentially the reason. Details around that. And so I got called up to the, I guess it was some colonel, maybe the deputy chief of the maintenance division or something, one day. And it was, you know, one of those conversations. Today's the first day of the rest of your life. And I was like, oh, it's that day, is it?
Mm-hmm.
We think it's better that you move on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it will just say termination during probation.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. no specifics. Because mm-hmm. I had performed pretty well as an apprentice. And,
mm-hmm.
And so that was it. I didn't want to leave. It was sort of like, okay, now what am I going to do?
Right.
My sister had already gone to the States. She was in mm-hmm. Florida going to college. And so I moved in with a friend in Panama. And I think we still played a couple of gigs in the band I was in. But I didn't find any work there. I wasn't mm-hmm. really looking for work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of followed my sister mm-hmm. up to Florida. Ended up following my parents out to California, and then life moved
Did you
on.
Go to college? Did you?
I went to community college in 75, studied music and commercial music, and ended up getting a job in music preparation, which mm-hmm. I've been doing for 30 years now.
Mm-hmm. What is music preparation?
Music preparation is preparing music for performance. So if you were a composer and you composed a piece, let's say you're John Williams and you wrote the score to Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of our clients, so you'd give that to an orchestrator who would then orchestrate it for the band that's going to play it. He would give that to us, and we prepare the individual parts
okay.
for each musician in the orchestra.
Sure.
And get it to the stage, get it on the stand.
I have enough experience with music to actually understand what yeah. you're talking about. So
yeah. yeah. A lot of people don't. It's one of those behind the scenes, you know, post
uh-huh.
production
so
jobs.
With all the, you know, unspecified, you know, troubles that you had, you still are very nostalgic, and you come to the reunion, and you're so there's certainly no...
Yeah, well, there's relationships. I mean, you know, I don't even know if it's probably not Canal Zone specific, but I think to a large extent it is, only because you have so many generations, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember when I came to my first reunion. It was in the, you know, the mid-70s. They were having them in St. Pete. And I just remember seeing all these people that I grew up with,
mm-hmm.
all my mom's friends,
mm-hmm.
you know, my dad's friends. And it was kind of a very, kind of a warm, fuzzy feeling, you know, kind
mm-hmm.
of thing.
Sure.
And then over the years, you know, I've only been to about four or five in a, you know, you reconnect with people. Sometimes, you know, there's people that you see haven't changed, you know. If that guy was wild and crazy back then, he still is, mm-hmm. you know. Whereas other people have settled down, raised families, but you still have that connection of those mm-hmm. those times that you mm-hmm. spent together down there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a connecting point. And from there you either stay connected or don't, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a few people that I've stayed connected with. When I see them now, we talk about what we did then, and we talk about what's going on now.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas some people are still stuck back then.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to come to the reunion because they don't want to know about changes that have. They don't want to go back to Panama because mm-hmm. it's not the same as I remember it.
Yeah.
You know, for me, I love going back to Panama.
Uh-huh. You know? How often do you go back?
Not frequently at all. I've only been back, I think, maybe four times in uh-huh. the 30 years since I've left. So, you know,
yeah.
Now I've got two kids. It's a little more challenging, but we're going to mm-hmm. go down maybe Christmas or something.
Okay.
You know, I still have some friends down there. Mm-hmm. My mom still has friends down there, and she's in her 80s. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I go down and visit her friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you stop on the roadside and get a fresh coconut, and, you know, you can have that experience in Mexico, but if you grew up in Panama, it's even better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go back and as an adult, I can appreciate the culture more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when people, you call them on the phone and they say, oh yeah, come on by. They mm-hmm. stop everything
mm-hmm.
for you to come by. You know, up here, everybody's too busy, you know. I'll pencil you in, you know, for next month. So.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I see
the
next people are coming in. So thank you very much for your... Oh, let me go ahead and stop this.